Thank you. Yeah, I was giving a talk like this, but in a bigger room, and that same information had somehow leaked out. Either I leaked it out or the introducer did. And it was actually an NSF site visit. And we were in the generator room that you'll see a picture of, which is very noisy. And so I just raised my voice, and other people were running around trying to fix the audio. And my remark was that my father used to always say that if the truth is on your side, you don't need amplification. And and so at the next Christmas, I told my father that he had said this. And so we had an agreement. I'm allowed to quote him as long as I tell him what he said after the fact. So indeed, I'm going to give a review talk on the uses of very high magnetic fields. Magnetism, in some ways, gets an unfair advantage. It's the only one of the fundamental forces that you can play with. Nuclear is kind of out of reach. Gravity, you know, what goes up must come down. But magnetism, you can play with. And so it does hold people's attention, and you can give these sorts of talks to all age groups. But by the same token, the importance of magnets and magnetic field technologies really gets short shrift. If I were to ask people to, you know, turn in all of the magnets they're carrying, you wouldn't be able to listen to your iPods. If you had any laptop or something, if you're trying to get some work done this hour, you'd have to turn that in. And the story goes on and on. So anyway, the National High Magnetic Field Laboratory is funded by the NSF, and we get substantial support from the state of Florida and the DOE. It's three branches, so we're the country's largest national lab. It takes three airplanes and a two-hour car ride to get from one end to the other. This is the largest facility here. This is 370,000 square feet. At the end here, you've got a 48 megawatt power supply. So when we're running our magnets, we use about 7% of the power of the city of Tallahassee. And at this end, far away from that end, we have a building with no structural steel in it for the NMR and MRI magnets. And we have the world's largest DC magnet. We have the largest NMR magnet, not necessarily in peak field. There are some 950 megahertz magnets out there. 900 is 21 Tesla. But ours has a bore of 105 millimeters, which is twice the diameter, so we can do MRI in this machine. If you go to University of Florida, there's two branches down there. One works at very low temperatures. They have nuclear demagnetization stages. They can spend 6 weeks at 1 millikelvin, and they have a 17 Tesla magnet. And there are some systems that are so clean that it's really the ratio of the magnetic field energy over KT that counts for the physics. It's much easier to drop temperature than it is to raise magnetic fields. So they work in the ultra-low temperature. And then there's a group that is just world-class in magnetic resonance imaging. And they have an 11 Tesla 400 millimeter bore magnet. And you already get a sense of the breadth of the research at the magnet lab. It comes out in also in how we describe the magnets. So the condensed matter physicists talk about Teslas. The NMR guys, biochemistry guys, talk about megahertz. The MRI guys talk about cat magnets, rat magnets, mouse magnets. So this is a cat magnet. And then we have a pulsed magnet lab out in Los Alamos. They're particularly good at shipping energy from one building to the next, or one mesa to the next. We have the country's largest motor generator set. It's if it were hooked up to a nuclear power plant, which was the original plan to then make steam to then generate power, this would generate 1.4 gigawatts, which is two-thirds the capacity of Hoover Dam. What we do is we spin up this motor generator, and this is not the tallest person in the lab right here. The shaft of this motor generator is a meter and a half thick. This is the shaft. This is one of the techs servicing the windings. It looks exactly like the inside of some, you know, HO race car or something. If you open it up, it's just bigger. And so we do pulse magnets out there. Oh, there's the guy. Okay. A lot of words on this slide, but I'll be coming back to it throughout the talk. First of all, this is a broad enough topic that I'm certainly going to say some things that are wrong in detail. It's in areas of science in which I'm not a specialist. If I waited to get all my facts exactly straight, then my story would be out of date. So, it's not so easy that a caveman could do it, but you need to be an educated caveman, I guess. So in physics, a lot of the work is on quantum matter. So this is addressing our limited understanding of systems in which the electrons strongly interact. So this is condensed matter physics, but where you can't just take a simple approximation that the electrons can be treated as nearly independent of one another. You've got so many electrons in a volume of space. Well, okay, let's use an example closer to home. If you have the number of citizens of Canada in a place as big as Canada, they're largely non-interacting. You don't get strange behaviors. If you put them all onto Manhattan, you get all kinds of weird things happening because there's stronger interactions. Well, what happens in solids is that each of the electrons has a different energy. You put the electrons in the lowest energy states first, and then you fill up until you've filled with all your electrons. But it's only electrons that are up at the highest energies, or at least within some thermal energy of that highest energy, that can take part in most of the correlated behaviors, superconductivity, various density waves, et cetera, et cetera. And so for some materials, you can treat that as such a small number that these electrons only weakly interact, that the vast sea of electrons underneath them doesn't play a big role. But for certain materials, and now we basically have solved the easy ones and we're working on the hard ones, you can't make those simple approximations. The simple approximation is called the Landau-Fermi liquid theory, and strongly interacting electrons or quantum matter or the bumper sticker description changes as often as the funding agencies demand, but it's all the same science. And I personally believe that when strongly interacting systems are solved, that it really will be some profound breakthrough in theory. That's as profound, for example, as renormalization group was for our understanding of thermally driven phase transitions. So this really has been an obstacle, and that's the signature of an important problem. Complex fluids. In condensed matter physics, we're often trying to make materials as pure as possible. The silicon industry relies on the fact that you can make silicon to, insane levels of purity. In the two-dimensional electron system that I worked on for my thesis and which you get fractional quantum Hall effect and other things that non-specialists don't necessarily need to know, the system is so clean that the electrons travel millimeters before they scatter. So nature doesn't give you those kinds of samples. Nature is pretty messy, and we've got techniques using high magnetic fields that study, for example, petroleum, which is one of the most complicated mixtures that's out there. Structure, dynamics, and function. The idea here is that the electron has its own magnetic moment, as do nuclei. If you put in a magnetic field, you tune those energy levels, they've got natural frequencies of precession, like tops, and that can be used to study how molecules are moving, how membranes transport ions, and mapping entire brains. Material science, you can use those same resonances to understand what is happening at specific elements in complicated materials. And if I've got time at the end, I'll mention a light source that we would like to build in the terahertz to infrared regime. What should I be aiming at as a finishing time? Sorry? 5 o'clock, okay. Today? So take you back a bit. We started with lodestones 2,000 years ago. They were known. There's some very interesting writings in the early Greek writings about lodestones. The Chinese actually realized that slivers of lodestones could be used as a navigational tool, and it's actually a very interesting question to ask. Why didn't then the Chinese nucleate the age of exploration? And at least the discussions I've heard, it's as much, what was the goal of the nation at that time? They had the spices close enough, was maybe the only reason. The nails are a newer phenomenon. In the 1200s, Europe caught up, and this fellow discovered magnets have two opposing ends, and he actually showed that lodestone could magnetize a needle that was otherwise not magnetic, and that's the birth of the modern compass. This fellow discovered that the Earth is magnetic. He made a sphere. Every time I give this talk, I keep thinking I should rotate this 90 degrees. This is the north pole of the sphere and the south pole. And then he put little needle-like pieces on the surface, and he mapped the fringe field, and he recognized that this is exactly the kind of thing that's happening with the Earth, which is, you know, quite a leap of intuition. The north pole is a south magnetic pole. If you learn nothing else today, because the needle in the compass, you designate north, you paint red, it points to the geographical north, so that means it has to be a southern, that means that it has to be attracted to a southern magnetic pole. So how do we make the strongest magnets in the world? The Earth's field is 0.4 Gauss. The iron oxide magnets that are the standard refrigerator magnet are 600 Gauss. There was about $1 billion spent to develop neodymium iron boron magnets. A lot of it was from the car industry because they wanted to make lighter weight and more powerful starter motors. And this development has really expanded the role of motors in everyday life. Power windows in your car, the power locks, stronger robots, cordless drills. It's not just developing battery technologies. It's actually developing a motor that can give you higher torque with lower mass. That's 4,000 Gauss, and that's near the limit for permanent magnets. You can only polarize so many of the electrons in a material, and that will give you the upper limit. And if you, you know, kind of want to think carefully, maybe we'll be able to double this. You know, maybe there's some secret out there to tripling it, but you're not going to get orders of magnitude stronger. And these are the magnets you can purchase more and more because they've learned how to coat them so that they don't crack. Actually, they're ceramics. You've got this periodic table, and they're bringing in some F electrons in order to get a lot of polarized electrons. So this is near the limit for permanent magnets. So then you switch to electromagnets. And we're going up to 450,000 Gauss for the DC magnets. So this we can turn on for hours at a time. And our pulsed magnet gets up to 900,000 Gauss for milliseconds at a time. You have to solve several problems here. This magnet will heat up. So we have to pump water through the magnet to keep it cool enough that it doesn't melt. The pulsed magnets, and we also have to be willing to spend about $3,000 an hour on the electricity bill. The pulsed magnet, you don't worry about the cooling problem. You turn it on and off fast enough so that it doesn't melt. So these magnets are less than a second, typically. 10 milliseconds for one technology, 2 seconds for another technology. And the big problem that you have to solve for all high magnetic field magnets, whether superconducting, DC resistive, or pulsed, are the forces. So the big forces you generate are like crushing a beer can. They're axially compressive, radially explosive. If you go 12 feet underwater, you have an extra 6 pounds per square inch of pressure on your eardrum. And so, you know, you can feel that on your eardrum. Submarine down at 2,000 feet has 1,000 psi. The ocean floor, 6,000 psi. I didn't realize that there's only been one expedition to the bottom of the Marianas Trench. It's sufficiently challenging, and we can now do it remotely, that we tend to send remote vehicles. If only we could learn that lesson for space. That's just an aside. I hope there's nobody funded by NASA here. The pressure inside our pulsed magnet at 80 Tesla, 800,000 Gauss, is 200,000 PSI. This exceeds the pressure that most steels can handle. In units that aren't determined by the length of King Charles I's foot, this is 130 kilograms per square millimeter. I could actually swing on a wire that's a square millimeter. So we actually have to do research on nanocomposite materials in order to pin the dislocation motion, if you will, to arrest the propagation of crystalline defects through the material that can be thought of as microcracks. You know, if you take a paper clip, you can bend it once or twice, it's fine. Then you start to see the cracks getting bigger, and finally it breaks. So pulsed magnets are applied metal fatigue. And so we need to have a nanoscale structure that gives us a very strong material. This is diameter of a human hair. This is a test sample. I've got another slide that actually will make it a little bit easier to see. So it's 20% niobium droplets and 80% copper. It does not form a constant alloy. The niobium does not dissolve into the copper. It stays as droplets, and then you draw the wire. Then you restack the wire, and you draw the wire. And we reduce the cross-sectional area by four orders of magnitude. And then you etch away the niobium. And I don't know if you can see in the back of the room, but there are these ribbons of niobium. This is 1 micron. So these ribbons are getting down to less than 100 atoms thick. And there's interfaces everywhere between what is nominally disordered copper, which is face-centered cubic, and niobium ribbons, which are very well ordered, and it's body-centered cubic. So there's really no slip plane, no dislocation propagation that can get all the way through your material. And as a research topic, not in the conductors we put into our magnets, but pushing this material science as far as it can go, they've actually reached the ultimate tensile strength in a macroscopic, you know, tens of microns size wire. And the ultimate tensile strength, as you might imagine, is when you break every single chemical bond simultaneously. So we end up being in the position of these spiders. If we had a higher strength material, it would lead directly to higher magnetic fields. If you know, we had a chemical bond, to reflect on your introduction, if God gave us a chemical bond that was twice as strong, we could make a magnetic field that's square root of 2 bigger. And so these spiders are ambitious. And the caption, you know, if we pull this off, we'll eat like kings. So, and unfortunately, some of us are about as realistic in our ambitions. You know, if there's an astronomer in the audience, we try to get mega Gauss, and we know that in the universe there are mega Tesla. And so, you know, we're getting hammered by the natural world. What can you do with 1.4 gigawatts? You can power Los Angeles, or you can pulse one magnet. This has exactly the same energy as the 1.3 gigawatts of the car in Back to the Future, if you go back. And at the time, this was the highest density power source at Universal. So we take the inertial storage of energy here, 200, I keep forgetting if it's tons or kilograms, so there's three orders of magnitude there. A really big thing, we're spinning at 1800 RPM. We throw a switch, in 1 second, it puts 250 megajoules into this magnet. 500 sticks of dynamite, 500 jelly donuts. But you get the energy fast, like a stick of dynamite. You know, the magical thing about jelly donuts is not that they taste good, it's that it takes a long time to get the energy out of them. And of course, the sample is sitting in the center of this magnet. And it's applied metal fatigue. So this is what the magnet looked like at 9:15 a.m. This is extra digits of precision to give the verisimilitude of truth. When we're ready to pulse the magnet, all personnel evacuate the building. The generator is spun up to 1,800 RPM. We throw the switch, the generator spins down to about 1,500 RPM in a second. It doesn't like to do that. And then the magnet screams and goes up to, in this case, 600,000 Gauss, and sometimes things go a bit wrong. So we made 5 tons of debris in just a second here. You'll notice this is the Magnet Lab logo, this is the NSF logo. After the fact, the Magnet Lab logo stuck around. And the NSF logo got the hell out of Dodge, which just shows how intelligent they are. We found it about 40 meters away. We also found chunks of the magnet about 40 meters away. We took the magnet out of the pit, and sure enough, it crushed axially. We've turned it on its side. This is now only about 1 meter apart. It used to be about 2 meters apart. That, it's also the right-hand rule, works. This is a thin-walled plastic tube. And the sample survived inside this explosion. We pulled the magnet apart. This is the world's strongest conductor. This is the world's toughest steel. It turns out the problem was in the steel. They had done the wrong heat treatment. Basically, we're at the edge of metallurgical science as well. We were the most interesting thing on the mesa at Los Alamos for metallurgists, and they came and looked at every single square inch of the surface of every crack looking for a nucleation point, and it turns out that the whole thing was just brittle. You know, we had built the magnet with glass reinforcement. You know, it's strong, but it's very brittle. So we've got our limitations, but, you know, until you spread your wings, you'll have no idea how far you can walk. So these are the records for, it works its way through. These are the records versus year of different magnet technologies. So superconducting, resistive, these are the ones that cost a lot of energy. The hybrid is actually joining together of superconducting and resistive magnets. And then you can trade off the time at field for the peak field. So the magnet lab has quite a few superconducting magnets for these three areas of research. I'll talk about ion cyclotron resonance, which is electrospraying ions into a uniform magnetic field, and they undergo cyclotron orbits, which have a frequency proportional to 1 over their mass. So this is the world's most sensitive scale. You can weigh molecules with an accuracy of 100 parts per billion. The 900 megahertz MRI magnet, this is state-of-the-art for NMR, but the bore is bigger, and so you can do MRI at very high magnetic fields. We have also, actually, this record's since been broken. There's YBCO tape, high-temperature superconducting tape, that now is sufficiently mechanically robust that we built, in this case, a 7 Tesla coil that slipped into one of our 20 Tesla resistive magnets to get 27 Tesla. The world's been stuck at 20 Tesla for decades now. And we've now since made a 3 Tesla high TC coil and put it in a 31 Tesla background field. So we're pursuing funding to build a 32 Tesla superconducting magnet. This is our resistive magnets, 35 Tesla or 45 Tesla if you put a superconducting magnet on the outside and then a resistive magnet on the inside. And then the pulsed magnets, 60 Tesla if you want to have a 2-second long pulse. I didn't mention that magnet that I was talking about that exploded, we had a 250 megajoule feedback loop. So it wasn't just an LC half sinusoid pulse shape. We could go up and then fix the field at 60 Tesla for a tenth of a second to do, in one case, specific heat at 60 Tesla. And then the shorter pulse magnets, 1 to 10 milliseconds, we're aiming for 100 Tesla. I change this every year. And we've gotten to 89 so far. And we're really working on getting the engineering experience. Okay, I'll now ratchet through these different categories. The first is quantum matter. I've reworded things a little bit. So this is putting metals on teeter-totters, scotch-taped induced relativity, and materials research saving lives for more than 2,000 years. So if you take a material and you filled up these electronic states and you fill the lowest energy states first, and then you end up, as I said earlier, studying what are the highest energy electrons, what energy are they at, and what momenta do they have. And it turns out in many physical quantities, this happens to be the Hall resistance, but also in the resistivity or the magnetization, or I was talking about specific heat yesterday in a more specialized talk, you get these oscillations that are periodic in 1 over magnetic field. And those will tell you what are the highest energy electrons in material, the Fermi surface as it's called, which will determine many of the physical properties, certainly that are due to the electronic structure in a material, metal, insulator, spin density wave, magnet, et cetera, et cetera. And you can measure other materials where there are loads and loads of these oscillations. When Landau first realized that you would see these oscillations, he purportedly felt that they would never be observed. It's far too small an effect. Well, not only are they observed quite a bit, but they're observed now up to, in this case, 68 Kelvin. We've gone up to above 100 Kelvin because we're going to such high magnetic fields. This is actually a material in which these oscillations in the magnetization of the material, and you can tell there are several frequencies. There's a beat frequency, there's the frequency you can see with your eyes. We were able to trace that up to high enough temperatures that we actually went through a structural phase transition, the Martensitic phase transition, which is the one that's important for strengthening steel. We had the material that has the lowest energy or the lowest temperature Martensitic phase transition, and we found that the electronic structure helps drive that phase transition. And so this was a very nice result because usually people think of this as only being a low temperature. You know, here's 1 Kelvin to 4 Kelvin in this experiment. They think of it as a low temperature experiment. So pulsed magnetic fields have really revolutionized these quantum oscillation experiments in high temperature superconductors. Louis Taillefer, who was here, went to the Toulouse Magnet Lab in France, and that's where he got these data in May of 07, which has really re-excited a major area in high-temperature superconductors. Compounds with heavy electron masses, so these are electrons that act very sluggishly as if they have a high mass. A localized electron has an infinite mass. It doesn't respond to an electric field. A free electron has a mass of one, and there are quite a few materials that have masses of several hundred electron masses, and that makes it harder to see the quantum oscillations. Disordered materials, it's very difficult to see the oscillations. When KT is big, it's difficult to see the oscillations, but by going to high magnetic fields, you amplify this exponentially, and so this really has become quite an industry in recent years. You can also take a material and tilt it in magnetic field. And the angle between the magnetic field and the electrons will give you these oscillations. And without going into a lot of detail, the resistance versus this is angle, this is resistance, you can break down the Fermi surface in terms of a basis function, a set of basis functions, and you can get the first approximation of the Fermi surface, which would just be a cylinder, then this first bubbling, and then you can start to work with an axial quantum number. And this is actually a Fermi surface that's been built up in great detail of one of the high-temperature superconductors. Now, this is the only complete mapping of a Fermi surface in one of these high-temperature superconductors. This is the Scotch tape-induced relativity. If you take graphite and put Scotch tape on it, and you know how to do it, you can actually get single layers of this hexagonal array of carbons. And they conduct electricity very well. And as you might imagine, if you put electrons on a lattice and you put them in a magnetic field and you start threading flux quanta through here, you might very well get some new quantum mechanical effects. And the dispersion relation is linear in momentum. It's not exactly because the things are relativistic, but it's the linear dispersion relation that causes me to claim this is Scotch tape-induced superconductivity. And indeed, if Andre Geim, who discovered this and has done a lot of the early spectacular work on this, if he does win the Nobel Prize, I think he'll be the first person to win both an Ig Nobel Prize for levitating frogs and a Nobel Prize, so you know, stay tuned. And so here's quantum Hall effect, where they're putting a bias voltage on the material. They're measuring the Hall effect, and they see the quantum Hall effect. And they're measuring the resistance, and they see zero resistance states wherever there's plateaus. I won't go into the details of quantum Hall effect here, but this is the very high field limit of those quantum oscillations you saw in the previous slide. It's when you've got such a large energy spacing between these quantized energy levels that you can start to study correlated electron effects. And this is different. The plateaus are at 1/2, 3/2, 5/2. Typically, in materials, they go 1, 2, 3, 4. And that has to do with this dispersion relation. And then another example that I'll use is the Terracotta Army. This army, as you probably know, was buried with the first emperor of China. And this army, each one is an individual. You can tell what rank they were in the army based upon hairstyles and their uniforms. And they were colored very brightly. And they were meant to protect the emperor in the afterlife instead of, you know, killing real soldiers. And the coloring, all of these are naturally occurring materials that were used all over the world, except for the blue and the purple. And a very refined metallurgical process was developed to create these two colors. These were state secrets for China at this time. And in fact, it was only recently that they were able to reproduce the metallurgy involved. And this Han purple, it turns out, is also a quasi-2D magnetic insulator with a gapped spin-dimer ground state. And we're pretty sure that they didn't know that. So this system, these are electrons in a square array, and it's actually two planes of them. So they're dimerized. So spin one half, and these end up being so strongly coupled that they act like a spin one. So they act like a boson on a square lattice. So your ground state and zero magnetic field is a singlet. You've got some gap to the triplet excitations. You apply a magnetic field, here in this case about 20 tesla, and what you've done is you've lowered the spin plus one state in energy, and whenever you give nature a very high degeneracy, a lot of low energy degrees of freedom, nature tends to do something quite creative with it. In a single electron picture, this would just keep plowing down, and all you would do is get magnetization of zero that would then suddenly become magnetization of one in units of J. But in fact, what happens is that instead of creating just this local spin flip excitation, you create a triplon. You create a wave-like triplet state. And these are bosons, and they bose condense. So this is the magnetic analog of Bose-Einstein condensation in the atomic gases, in the atomic systems. And to show you that it's a Bose-Einstein condensation, this is specific heat data taken at 37 tesla. And this is a lambda transition quite clearly. This is the model for a lambda transition and looks, you know, almost as good as people have observed in helium-4. And so that system has become a very well-studied system, in part because the high-temperature superconductors are just a single-layer square lattice of electrons. And the heavy the high-temperature superconductors show their own interesting physics. If you happen to have two of these layers together, you end up making bosons. The physics changes dramatically. So now shifting to complex fluids, here we're going to weigh molecules that weigh the same. We're going to look at petroleum goop and pee, tiny little holes and tiny little viruses and insect spit and worm sex. So this is what can you do with a very sensitive scale to measure mass. So this is the mass in Daltons, which is just a fancy word for the weight of a proton. And you get a Fourier transform. Remember, we're spraying in a very complicated ionized gas, we're electro spraying, so it's a spray can, into a uniform magnetic field, and you get cyclotron motion. You want to do a very high magnetic field to give you the mass resolving power. They've been able to resolve over 100,000 distinct molecules in a single petroleum sample. So why is that important? Well, they can fingerprint individual reservoirs. So if they have a well here and a well there, the mix is different, as you might imagine, for pretty much every oil reservoir in the world. And if these end up looking the same in ion cyclotron resonance, then you probably are drawing from the same reservoir. You drill here and you'll get oil as well. The other thing is that they can tell which of the compounds have sulfur, and they can tell where the sulfur is. And this is, of course, one of the bad things in petroleum. They've been able to study which compounds dissolve in fresh water and salt water. Which has actually changed the way that they clean up spills. In the early days, in fact, the cleanup was worse than the original spill. They've analyzed pipeline clogging. The Point Barrow pipe, if it clogs, and it does clog, it's $60 million a day. And they don't know what this stuff is. At least they didn't know what this stuff is. Turns out that the new post-World War II pipes, which are much higher grade steel, clog much faster than the crappy old pipes. And they didn't know why that was either. And what they thought this was a polymerization of molecules in petroleum that would then get sticky and played out. It turns out that it's actually relatively small molecules that are just mechanically and intertwined and hydrogen bonding. And so that changes the way the chemists try to attack that. And then if we can refine sour crudes, we're going to run out of sweet crude. This is an illustration of the kind of resolving power you have. This is a time of flight mass spectrum. And so this is 178.04 proton masses, 178.1. And these are four molecules that are of interest. The mass is 178.06. 178.07, 178.08, 178.085. And you're not going to be able to resolve those. And with the ion cyclotron resonance, it's no problem at all. And so this mass resolving power ends up being very important for very many ways. One is that you can look at biological fluids like cerebrospinal fluid and look for disease markers, or blood, look at the bloodstream, look at urine, and look for markers of disease. So just as the PSA test is looking for an antigen a compound that indicates that you've got prostate cancer present, there may be opportunities to diagnose all sorts of diseases by being able to recognize what molecules are in your mix. Amyloid mixtures, these agglomerations of protein fragments and plaque deposits in the brain are being studied with this. Nutritional components in food and food processing assurance might be an area in which this would help quite a bit. They can go to a fire and collect remnants of the accelerant that was used, and they can track it down to, in some cases, the gas station that the petroleum was purchased at. They've also used this technique in a very creative way. You know, viruses are, at the level I understand, just a soccer ball with some holes in the surface that allow the RNA to get in and out, and that RNA hijacks cells. Well, the X-rays can look at just one plaquette, one surface of the soccer ball, and give you the whole structure, which is a real tangle. But the X-rays are not able to get you the whole assembly. So this is the leather out of which they've made the soccer ball, but we don't know if that's the outside or that's the outside. So what they'll do is they'll expose this plaquette to deuterium, which has a heavier mass than hydrogen. There's loads of hydrogen here, and they will fragment this in a controlled way, and they're able to tell that the deuterium transfers at about 100 per hour on these surfaces, and then it's slower and slower as you go into the interior of this this big structure. And I'm still wondering why the square is there. And then what they did is that they took the whole capsid and exposed the whole capsid to deuterium, and the exchange when they did the analysis was only on this surface. So this is the outside. So why is that important? Well, these pores that pass the RNA are not just simple cylindrical holes. And the details of the shape are critically important for allowing that RNA to pass. And the leading strategy for combating viral drugs is to find a cork that, in effect, will block that channel. And it's also not statics. There's all kind of dynamics involved in well. So knowing which one is the outside rather than the inside is very important. Oh, here's another thing that NMR is doing. Won't go into a lot of detail, but this is the influenza virus. The influenza virus needs acid to survive. And this amantadine, which is trying to attack the flu, a couple of people got that, clogs these channels. And it kills the virus in that way. And it turns out that what the amantadine does is it not only plugs the pore, but it cants it. If it's a cylinder like this, it ends up becoming a cylinder like that. And with NMR, where they're able to measure distances, they're also able to study these pores through which either drugs or RNA pass. We've got the world's most sensitive NMR. So why is that important? You can now get an NMR spectrum from a single animal. It used to take 10,000 milkings of a walking stick in order to analyze its venom. So here's a walking stick that, you know, I find one of the coolest things is that it can spray this stuff in any direction. You know, it's got this exoskeleton. As far as I can tell, it just kind of hunkers down, and anywhere there's an aperture, it comes out. But they can tell where the threat's coming from and spray it in any direction. But as you might imagine, there's a huge interest in what they call natural products, going out into the world, figuring out what evolution has developed in terms of chemical warfare or chemical defenses. If you're an animal, you can fight or flee. If you're a plant, it's pretty much chemical warfare. So what we've got is out of high TC, we've got a very small pickup coil, and we're able to measure the spectrum of just a single insect's venom. They were able to find this anisomorphal compound. It turns out that this thing has quite a few different configurations, different stereomers and isomers and various other things, and NMR can tell the difference between those those structures. So here's a couple of the things they can do. NMR measures the distances. Each of these resonances tells you the distances between two of the different atoms. If you measure all of these distances, you can reconstruct the structure. But they not only see differences between animals, they can look at a single animal at different times. So they, for example, in response to stress, they can see how the animal changes its venom either lack of food or some particular attacker. This Peru walking stick has its own isomer, which is nominally exactly the same mass, but because the distances are slightly different, you can detect with high field NMR. This is the same individual. This is the worm sex, so I cut out the video here. This is using that same probe to basically find out what small molecules that are detected using this ultrasensitive probe cause behavioral changes. And it turns out that the same molecule controls both a hibernation phase, where if in the absence of food, this worm goes into a suspended animation state. And it turns out that just in higher concentrations, it basically leads to mating behavior. And so, it was known that these things were controlled by a chemical. It was not known that it was the same chemical. And my understanding is what they do is they observe what the worms are doing. They then put them into a blender, and then they analyze the soup that comes out. And when they're when they're behaving this way, and they go into the blender, then they see the same compounds, but they see more of this key pherome. So that's something that you need to have high fields to get the resolution in NMR spectra, but you also need to have a unique probe. And now Bruker is actually starting to manufacture this high TC probe. Structure dynamics and functions. I'll talk about advanced MRI of mouse brains and fatheads, and watching water diffuse, which is like watching grass grow. So stem cells. The reason stem cells are so exciting is that these are cells that haven't yet grown up and figured out what they want to become when they grow up. So these are cells that for some reason are the building blocks that eventually decide somehow that they want to be a nose or an ear or something like that. So what we've done is that we can track stem cells by labeling them with this biocompatible nanoparticle. So gadolinium in the center, these are individual atoms. You decorate it with organic hair so that it becomes biocompatible. You put it into stem cells. So here are stem cells with the quantum dots in them, and then just to confuse things, what's blue here is red there, what's red here is blue there. This is a mouse brain where we've lit up the stem cells that have been tagged with these gadolinium quantum dots, and this is the area of the brain that was deprived of oxygen, and they're able to watch, if you will, the motion of these stem cells as they move towards the damaged area and attempt to regrow that part of the brain. With this magnet, we've done the highest definition MRI of a mouse brain. So the voxel size, if you will, the volume cell size is now getting to be a few microns on a side. And if you can go to still higher and higher fields, eventually you might be able to look at individual structures inside individual cells. We've already imaged a single living cell, but it was one of the biggest cells in nature. The future is quite exciting for in vivo MRI. Obviously, with gadolinium, we're not going to do the studies on human beings, because it's a heavy metal, and so it's toxic. But as you go to higher and higher fields, you can start to look at more and more different nuclei. Also, we're developing, and when I say we, I'm sure that you've surmised that it's not me, but it's also not the people at the magnet lab. I should make that clear, probably should have made it clear already. We have 1,000 scientists who visit every year as part of our user program. We provide the magnetic fields free of cost. You pay the air ticket. If you can't pay the air ticket, we actually try to do that these days as well, since grants have gotten so tight. But you put in a proposal for MagnaTime. It's competitive. If you're awarded MagnaTime, you come, you take your data for free. If you want to use our internal expertise, we're happy to help. If you have control over the experiment and you're able to use the MagnaTime wisely, then you can work by yourselves in the magnet lab. And so these are some chemical engineers, I think, who are working on these things. And they can put different metals and molecules hanging off of it to create tunable contrast. As you go to higher magnetic fields, you need different materials in order to get the contrast. And they can actually, in principle, develop different color by looking at which stem cells go in which direction, etc. We're also the home of the Mouse Brain Atlas, which is three words I never thought I would say together. MRI can go beyond pretty pictures. If you go to the doctor and you get an MRI done, they look at the image and they interpret it. But they don't know how you're different from average, except from their own pattern recognition through their professional experience. So what we've done is there's an international effort to basically collect together at the Magnet Lab all of the high-resolution scans of mouse brains, merge it all into one massive data set, and define normal, the normal mouse brain, by averaging data from many brains. And then you can query this database in any way you want, but you might, for example, be able to highlight regions that are larger or smaller as a result of either a disease or genetic manipulation. It's able to edge detect, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a database, if you will, that's freely available. Diffusion, as you might imagine, in fibrous structures like your spinal cord, is highly anisotropic. Magnetic resonance is sensitive to molecular diffusion in the direction of the gradient that's applied. And so by putting the gradient in different directions, they can tell how well the water diffuses through either the brain or, in this case, a severed spinal cord. This is a healthy spinal cord. This is a severed spinal cord where you can tell that the nerves at the bottom have not matched up with the nerves at the top. And so they're able to quantify anisotropy. They're able to look at spinal cords attempting to heal themselves. It turns out that by looking at the genes that are expressed in response to spinal cord damage, it's exactly the same mix of genes that are expressed when you have a wound in your skin. So the body's responding the same way. And the problem, at least at some level, is that the spinal cord nerve cells are so long that when they sever, they're not able to reconnect very well. The final area is doing nuclear resonance across the entire periodic table, finding the unpaired spin, the unrequited electron love, making energy the old-fashioned way like the leaves do, and better living through magnets. So here's an example where by going to very high magnetic fields, we are able to use oxygen 17, which is a quadrupolar nucleus, so it's sensitive to electric field gradients, in order to watch potassium ions go through an ion channel in this model of a membrane. And of course, our entire nervous system is dependent upon the proper function of these ion channels. The electrical signal in your nerves propagates not the way copper works. We don't send electrons down our nerves. It's lateral motion. So it's like if I had a rope tied at the wall and I snap the rope, you see the information go, but the rope is only moving normal to the propagation of the signal. Well, that perpendicular motion to the propagation of the signal is potassium ions and sodium ions going in and out of the nerve membrane. And so studying how those go through is quite important. As I said, O17 is a quadrupolar nucleus. In order to even look at O17, you have to have very, very high magnetic fields. And it can actually sense, as far as I can tell, these chemists have very fine tweezers, and they put the O17 here, and they put it there, and they get one signal if there's no potassium ion present, and then it shifts 40 parts per million if the potassium ion is nearby. So they're able to tell how that potassium ion moves through this channel, how long it spends at the various sites, et cetera. And we can detect these line shifts due to the potassium ions at a particular site along that ion channel. Well, why is that important? Well, MRI is pretty much just detecting where's the hydrogen in your body. So it's finding the water and the fat, basically. And you're not just water and fat. So second generation MRI and it's starting now, is imaging sodium or imaging potassium or imaging one of these other ions that your body has hijacked for some biological process. Well, quadrupolar nuclei that have higher spin are all over the periodic table. So in some sense, you're opening up the rest of the periodic table to NMR techniques. And this is important for catalysts, surface chemistry, where's lithium, porous materials, where do you get adsorbates on the surface of porous materials, et cetera, et cetera. So very high field NMR opens up quadrupolar nuclei for study. This is an iron compound. This is a big organic molecule that is using an iron atom for some important biological function. It turns out that in a zero magnetic field, you've got electron energy levels that are split quite dramatically as if there's an internal magnetic field. You turn on a magnetic field that you apply, and we go up to high magnetic fields, and you can watch these resonances move all over the place. You can map out what's called the G tensor. That will tell you information about where these iron levels are and where the iron atom is, what the local environment is for the magnetic moment of that iron atom. And it's difficult, apparently, to see this particular iron 2 oxidation state, and so you have to have high magnetic fields as well as high frequencies. So you need high frequencies in order to measure it at low fields, and then as you go up to higher and higher fields, it splits out. In 2012, we're going to have 36 tesla, which will do 1 terahertz electron spin resonance. This is what's available commercially. The yellow is what we'll have. And this is what's commonly available in labs today. So we do work on developing high-frequency spectrometers as well as high-field electron spin resonance. Just very quickly, you can watch BioJelly wiggle. These chemists can put some atom that has an electron spin locally on this wobbly thing with an alpha helix and another alpha helix. They can put it in various sites. They can measure as a function of temperature. I know it says negative Kelvin. That's what was in the paper. And they can measure at... it's chemistry. they can measure at different frequencies, different magnetic fields, in other words. They can measure as a function of temperature. These are data of the electron spin resonance, and they're able to therefore tell, this gives you a time scale on which you either get a response or you don't get a response when you've got a spin that's sitting there. How much is it moving? And so this will be usable in the future via spin labeling to probe dynamics of these big floppy molecules. And after all, it's the protein folding and the dynamics that determines function. There's just a lot of words I'm not going to go through. But you might imagine that in catalysts, you're looking for the unpaired electron. That's the chemically active electron. Electron spin resonance finds that. If you can go to higher and higher magnetic fields as you go down that's low fields, medium, high fields, you can see that you can actually measure these resonances and resolve them. That tells you that in this palladium compound, the unpaired electron is not sitting out here on these wings. It happens to be sitting in the center. So this might not be a good catalyst because the unpaired spin is not available to the environment. This is not just a hypothetical situation. The way that photosynthesis works is that the leaf absorbs a photon. It then transfers the electron to an iron atom, the proximity of an iron atom. So your body has hijacked these metallic ions in order to provide functions that aren't available just from carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and hydrogen. I'll skip that one. Better living through superconducting magnets. This is the proposed ITER plasma fusion experiment. This is a human being in 1950s clothing. This reactor will use $1 billion of niobium-based superconducting wire. And when the first batches were produced, it was too lossy to be used. And so we've helped sort out what the problem is in the niobium-3 tin wire. We've also built, as I said earlier, world record magnets made out of YBCO that might very well increase by 50%, maybe even a factor of 2, the magnetic fields that can be achieved with superconducting magnets. So you could do 35 tesla experiments in your laboratory. Of course, nobody would be able to work in the laboratory next to you, but that's their problem. Just assign it to a chemist. I've already pointed out that materials research have been saving lives for the next 2,000 years. Here's one more example. X-ray radiography is used to attack tumors. The X-rays go right through your body. So if you've got a tumor in your lung, what they do is the X-ray source, they tilt your body with respect to the source, and so they pass X-rays in every different direction. So the only part of your body that gets a high dose is the tumor. But of course, the rest of your body is getting a low dose. And that's part of the damage of X-ray chemotherapy or X-ray therapies. If we had very strong superconducting magnets, we might not have to use these very long proton accelerators to do proton radiation therapy. The reason protons are useful is that they go into the body, they penetrate a certain distance that's determined by their energy, and then they dump all of the energy within a millimeter. And so they go basically from full speed to zero. So if the tumor is deeper, you just turn up the energy of the protons. Right now, this is limited by the linear accelerator and the ability to focus protons. If you could go to very high magnetic fields, you might very well be able to make a proton source that's about the size of your X-ray source. And then basically proton radiography, as I understand it, would completely take over. So I've run out of time. I'll just say one thing, which is we recognize that there's a gap in the terahertz region. This is the visible spectrum infrared. This is microwaves. Electronics lives here. Optics lives there. And there are no tunable sources in this regime that have the functionality we would like. And so we are proposing a source, a light source, with all of these unique properties that will be located at the National High Magnetic Field Lab to do many of these experiments that I've been talking about, but with a laser that can be tuned, you can do two-color experiments. I'll just leave it at that. So thank you very much.